Some years ago, I visited Oxford University. Most visiting that glorious campus seek out first and foremost the Bodleian Library, or the incredible architecture and gleaming spires, or Oxford's art and its scholars. But as for myself, I was most interested in seeing a pub, a bar. Not any pub, but a particular pub known as the Eagle and Child. And there you see me, though I've cut out most of me from the picture because, you know, I'm thinner now, so. You know, I want to keep that image in your mind. Why was I so excited to be there? Because it was at the Eagle and Child that for many years, a group of writers and literary scholars would gather over drinks to read each other their work and to make suggestions to one another regarding their ongoing work. And at the heart of that circle were two men that could claim to be the two most influential writers in English in the 20th century, J.R.R. Tolkien and Clive Staples Lewis. It was Tolkien who wrote The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, the latter of which has sold over 150 million copies, I think more than almost any other work on earth in English, except for English translations of the Bible. Meanwhile, Lewis not only authored The Chronicles of Narnia for children, which is, as Avi mentioned, one of the most beloved children's series of all time, he also, through his books Mere Christianity, The Problem of Pain, Miracles, and so many more, became the most influential writer about religion in English for a popular audience in the 20th century and probably ever. Tolkien and Lewis were profound friends, and their books are made all the more mesmerizing when we understand that they were written in conversation with one another very often. And they would gather in this pub and elsewhere, reading each other's manuscripts and sending each other letters and comments about them. The group that met often in The Eagle and Child was known, as you can see from this picture of me actually in the pub, there's a description of it in the plaque right behind my head, this group was known as the Inklings. And it was made up of a series of individuals that changed over time, but there was no question that Lewis and Tolkien were the towering figures among the Inklings. Lewis and Tolkien had met at Oxford some years before. At that time, Lewis considered himself an atheist. And there was no indication from his first meeting with Tolkien that it would produce one of the most remarkable friendships in the history of writing, religion, and literature. Initially, Lewis recorded in his diary that evening the following almost literally backhanded compliment regarding Tolkien. This is what Lewis wrote, quote, "No harm in him, only needs a smack or so," end quote. That was Lewis's description of meeting J.R.R. Tolkien. Make of that what you will. Be that as it may, this friendship did flourish. And when Lewis in 1931 embraced a belief in God, he discussed this newfound faith with Tolkien in a walk outside, a conversation that led Lewis to embrace Christianity as well. Of course, no one would have guessed at that point in the early 30s that two nerdy academics in Oxford would write some of the most influential books in English ever. Lewis was a professor of literature and Tolkien of language, especially early English language. But what began with a conversation and conversion led to Lewis, by the beginning of World War II, becoming one of the most eloquent defenders of faith in general and Christian belief in particular in the world. And as war swept Europe, Lewis had an idea for a book of ethical instruction that would be utterly unlike any other ever written before or after. The idea was that the book could consist of letters from one senior devil in a demonic bureaucracy, writing to a junior devil who had been tasked with tempting one specific soul to achieve one particular person's damnation. The senior devil would be named Screwtape, and he would write to a devil named Wormwood. They would work for Satan, who would be called throughout the book in the letters, "Our Father below," below is hell. And these devils would refer to God throughout the letters as the enemy above, capital E for enemy. And through these letters about temptation, the idea of Lewis was that we would learn about avoiding temptation. By seeing things from evil's perspective, we would learn how to embrace the good and reject evil. According to many accounts, Lewis got the idea for the book by listening to a super boring sermon. And apparently he began to wonder what it would be like to hear an interesting speech from the opposite perspective, a speech advocating evil. Lewis wrote the following to his brother, Warney, quote, "Before the service was over, one would wish these things came more seasonably. I was struck by an idea for a book, which I think might be both useful and entertaining. It would be called As One Devil to Another, and would consist of letters from an elderly retired devil to a young devil who has just started work on his first quote-unquote patient. The idea would be to give all the psychology of temptation from the other point of view, end quote. This is what ultimately became a letter from not a retired devil, but a senior devil to a junior devil, known as the Screwtape Letters. Of course, with the book's focus on devils, the entire book would be written from a Christian perspective, and it's no surprise that when Screwtape Letters was first published in 1942, this is an image I found online of one of the original versions, it was dedicated, as you can see from another picture I found online, it was dedicated to the man who had played such an important role in Lewis's religious journey. As we see, it was dedicated to J.R.R. Tolkien. However, as I further discovered online, Tolkien was not that excited about this dedication for several reasons. First, and I'm quoting by what I saw from the wonderful Tolkien websites and Lewis websites online, Tolkien did not think that Lewis had come that far in his religious journey. He had only reconverted to Christianity in 1931, and all of a sudden he's becoming a theologian writing about the difference in good and evil. And secondly, and perhaps more interestingly, Tolkien, as a profoundly religious Catholic, was profoundly perturbed by the notion that one, even as a literary device, would seek to penetrate the mind of the devil, to penetrate the mind of evil incarnate. Now, of course, as a Jew, the entire perspective in which the book is premised is one that I reject, in that while I certainly believe in the existence of hell, I do not believe that Satan is a rebel who rules over it. I do not believe that Satan is seen as the father below of any spiritual beings. In standard Jewish teaching, Satan, Satan in the Tanakh, refers to an angelic prosecutor who works for God. And if there are aspects of the Screwtape Letters perspective with which I would differ, coming as it does from a Christian perspective, I have still learned an enormous amount Jewishly from this book, simultaneously enjoying its brilliance and its humor. Indeed, I would go so far as to say that it is one of the great Musar works of the 20th century. Musar, in Hebrew, referring to works that inspire religious and ethical improvement. The book covers a number of topics, but today, drawing on several of Screwtape's letters, I will focus, in order to illustrate how I learned from it and how we can all learn from this book, I will focus on the theme of time, its ethical and theological import, and how what Screwtape, or at least what Lewis is telling us through Screwtape, pithily parallels profound ideas in Judaism, allowing me ultimately to better understand and express them. So let's start with one letter. And the letter begins, as they all do, with, "My dear Wormwood." And here I have to make another literary connection to one of the great, great artistic achievements really in the history of the West, and that, of course, is the comic strip Calvin and Hobbes by Bill Waterston. Those who grew up with Calvin and Hobbes might remember that the name of Calvin's enemy, one of his enemies in the strip, his teacher, was named Miss Wormwood. That was taken directly from the Screwtape Letters. So you have, of course, theological embodiment of the names Calvin and Hobbes. These are theological and philosophical names. And then you have the reference to Lewis with Miss Wormwood. To my knowledge, his other nemesis, the young girl Susie, was not named for anybody in particular. So in this letter, Screwtape advises Wormwood that if he truly wishes to tempt the person that he seeks to lead astray, given that this person has now committed to Christianity, Wormwood, Screwtape writes, should seek to turn this person not directly to heresy, because that's not going to work, but rather, Screwtape advises, Wormwood should turn this person to a more fashionable approximation or imitation of traditional Christianity by tempting this person to embrace what is fashionable, what is new, what seems to be a new form of religious observance, but whose whole benefit, really, the whole lure of it, just comes from its fashionable nature. Screwtape writes the following to Wormwood, and again, this is evil writing. Quote, He advises Wormwood as follows, quote, "Substitute for the faith itself some fashion with a Christian coloring. Work on their horror of the same old thing." Same old thing is capitalized. "The horror of the same old thing is one of the most valuable passions we have produced in the human heart," we meaning the devils, "an endless source of heresies in religion, folly in counsel, infidelity in marriage, and inconstancy in friendship." In other words, the fear of the same old thing is always the source of sin, or often the source of sin. Why? Why is this so? Screwtip goes on to give us a brilliant, from his perspective, but in general also, a brilliant analysis of human nature. Screwtip writes, "The humans live in time and experience reality successively. To experience much of it, therefore, they must experience many different things." In other words, they must experience change. In other words, Screwtip is arguing, why are we so allured as human beings by what is new? Because actually, we are built to embrace some form of change. That is how God has made us. Now, if God has made us seek change, how ought we really to seek change? So Screwtip goes on to describe how the enemy, meaning God, actually seeks for us to embrace change. Screwtip writes, "And since they need change, the enemy, being a hedonist at heart," meaning God seeks to give us happiness, "the enemy has made change pleasurable to them, just as he has made eating pleasurable. But since he," meaning God, "does not wish them to make change any more than eating an end in itself, he has balanced the love of change in them by a love of permanence. He has contrived to gratify both tastes together in the very world he has made by that union of change and permanence, which we call rhythm. He gives them the seasons, each season different, yet every year the same, so that spring is always felt as a novelty, yet always as the recurrence of an immemorial theme. He gives them in his church a spiritual year. They change from a fast to a feast, but it is the same feast as before." That's Screwtape describing how God does it. Unlike the devil's perspective, Lewis is implicitly teaching us that change can be good. A desire for change was implanted by the Almighty within us. If it is joined with our equally implanted desire for permanence in the rhythm of a covenantal calendar. Now, if this is true for the Christian calendar, ladies and gentlemen, it's certainly true for Judaism, which of course had the calendar of religious rhythm before Christianity existed. We too, as Jews, move from feast to fast, from fast to feast. To be a Jew in time is to constantly experience change, but that change is part of a pattern, and that pattern is very old. It's not part of the same old thing. It is part of the same old thing. That pattern is many thousands of years old. The pattern that I observe are those observed by Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and Hillel, and by those who lived many years before him. And this brings us to the next point, that one of the most dangerous temptations is to evaluate something based only on its newness, based only on its newness, and by making that the moral evaluation of a phenomenon in our lives. Whether something is new or not does not determine whether it is good or bad. And so Screwtip goes on to further advise Wormwood, and he writes, "The greatest triumph of all is to elevate this horror of the same old thing into a philosophy so that nonsense in the intellect may reinforce corruption in the will. It is here that the general evolutionary or historical character of modern European thought, partly our work," meaning the devil's work, "comes in so useful. The enemy," meaning God, "loves platitudes. Of a proposed course of action, he," meaning God, "wants men, so far as I can see, to ask very simple questions. Is it righteous? Is it prudent? Is it possible?" Now, if, Screwtape continues, "we can keep men asking, is it in accordance with the general movement of our time? Is it progressive or reactionary? Is this the way that history is going?" they will neglect the relevant questions. And the questions they do ask are, of course, unanswerable, for they do not know the future. And what the future will be depends very largely on just those choices, which they now invoke the future to help them make. This is brilliant. In other words, Screwtape is saying, if we want to lead people astray, let people believe that history is always moving in a special, progressively new way. That can be the source of sin, where you take the human horror of the same old thing and turn it into what is seen as an enlightened philosophy. And this is brilliant because, of course, all the time it is standard political parlance to declare others on the wrong side of history. And very often it's those that cleave to traditional moral teachings that are decried as being on the quote-unquote wrong side of history. But history is not a train trip that brings us inevitably to stop after stop. It is a journey influenced by our choices, as Lewis says, influenced by choices made by leaders and choices made by individual human beings. The future, of course, is contingent. And part of the goal of the Jewish calendar in rooting us in the journey that is old, from fast to feast, from feast to fast, and the rhythm of change that is constantly old, is that it forces us year after year through years of change to remain rooted in the events of the past that our feasts and our fasts commemorate. We remember the Exodus from Egypt, and we remember the destruction of the temple. We relive those feasts and we relive those fasts, and reliving them allows us to make choices about the future. My favorite Tisha B'Av quote ever, and it's with this that I begin my Tikvah lectures in the calendar on Tisha B'Av. It is occurred when Menachem Begin arrived in 1977, right before Tisha B'Av, as the newly elected Prime Minister of Israel. He, of course, represented genuine change because, of course, this was the Mahapach when the old labor establishment was overthrown. But, of course, this was not the change that he was being asked to embrace. He was asked to embrace peace. Now, of course, Menachem Begin did embrace peace, but Menachem Begin met with Carter, and then he went on Meet the Press on Tisha B'Av. He went first to Shul the night of Tisha B'Av, sat on the floor, heard Eicha, Lamentations read, then in the morning he's on Meet the Press, and they ask him, what did you talk to President Carter about? What did he say to you? What did he say to him? And he says something like, before I answer that question, I just want to explain what this day is. And then he gives the exact number of years since 70 CE to 1977. He describes the precise legions of the Romans that destroyed Jerusalem. And then he says, all of our problems since then have been a result of that. And he effectively says, and it's my job as I face the future to ensure that that doesn't happen again. And so it's the future that's contingent. And Begin was saying that by reliving Tisha B'Av, he would ensure that he would embrace peace if it was prudent and if it was truly peace. And that reliving Tisha B'Av guided him as he faced reliving the past guided him as he faced the contingent future. He would not be just ordered and told which was the right side of history and which was the wrong side of history. Thus we have one example of how Lewis's description of time through the mirror image of the evil screw tape allows us as Jews to better understand what time means for us. With this in mind, I'd like to proceed to Screwtape's next discussion about time. And here, I need to give a bit of a Jewish preface. If Judaism has continually emphasized our obligations to resist the call of the age, to embrace the obligations that may seem at times to us the same old thing, if it teaches us to resist sin and our obligations to constantly, in Lewis's words, ask the fundamental questions, is it righteous, is it good, is it possible? If it constantly reminds us of our responsibilities to ask that question, these questions, it is because Judaism fundamentally teaches us that our lives on this earth are not ours. We do not own our lives, and that therefore, we do not own our time, which has been vouchsafed to us in life. Judaism believes that all we have is owned by God and loaned to us by God. Thus we will say soon, during the penitential prayers, the slichot, Hanushama lach v'haguf shalach, the body is yours, God, and the soul is yours. Each of us in our own lives on earth, with our lives, with our bodies, with our families, with our possessions, and with our time, each of us is only what Jewish law terms a shomer, a custodian. We are a guardian for the lives we live until the true owner comes to take it back. This is true of everything in our lives. It is true of the aspects of our lives that are most precious to us, which is our own lives, our time here on earth, and our children's lives on earth. There was one episode of The Simpsons where Homer is mad and Homer Simpson takes his anger out on his children, and his wife, Marge, criticizes him. He says, you can't take your anger out on your children. Homer says, why not? I own them. And Marge says something like, Homer, how can you say that? And he says, fine, we own them. The truth is, we're very possessive of what we love most in life. But in the end, nothing we have in life, even though that most precious to us, our lives and our children's lives are not ours. They are God's, and therefore, our time is not ours. The source of sin, rightly understood, is taking the opposite perspective, acting possessively over that which is most precious to us, acting possessively over our time. And it's with this in mind that Lewis gives us another missive from Screwtape to Wormwood, where Screwtape advises Wormwood that if you really wish to encourage sin, encourage this individual over which we've asked you to seek to lead astray, encourage this individual to see his life, and especially his time, as his own. Screwtape writes, quote, men are not angered by mere misfortune, but by misfortune conceived as injury. And the sense of injury depends on the feeling that a legitimate claim has been denied. The more claims on life, therefore, that your patient can be induced to make, the more often he will feel injured and, as a result, ill-tempered. Now you will have noticed that nothing throws him into a passion so easily as to find the tract of time which he reckoned on having at his own disposal unexpectedly taken from him. It is the unexpected visitor when he looked forward to a quiet evening, or the friend's talkative wife turning up when he looked forward to a tete-a-tete with a friend, that throw him out of gear. Now he is not yet so uncharitable or slothful that these small demands on his courtesy are in themselves too much for it. They anger him because he regards his time as his own and feels that it is being stolen. You must therefore zealously guard in his mind the curious assumption, my time is my own. In other words, Lewis is saying, what destroys relationships? If your wife, as your wife, would like to have a conversation with you during a time that you selfishly decided is going to be your own downtime, or if your friend shows up at a time when you had looked forward to having an evening all for yourself. That's how you destroy relationships with your spouse, with your friends, and of course, that's how you destroy your relationship with God, when you see your time is your own. And then Lewis goes on to end the letter with the following brilliant linguistic point, by noting through Screwtape to Wormwood, by speaking through a demon, that in the end we tend to speak possessively all the time. So making this slip, or rather Wormwood incentivizing his quote-unquote patient to make the slip into seeing his time as his own, is all too easy. Screwtape concludes, we produce this sense of ownership not only by pride, but by confusion. We teach them not to notice the different senses of the possessive pronoun, the finely graded differences that run from my boots through my dog, my servant, my wife, my father, my master, and my country to my God. They can be taught to reduce all these senses to that of my boots, the my of ownership. In other words, we all say my shoes, and we also say my children. But of course, I don't possess my children in the way that I possess my boots. My children are not mine at all. They are a precious gift vouchsafed by God, over which I am a custodian. Screwtape says you should try to elide the difference between all these minds, between all these my's. And then Screwtape continues, even in the nursery, a child can be taught to mean by my teddy bear, not the old imagined recipient of affection to whom it stands in a special relation, for that is what the enemy will teach them to mean if we are not careful, meaning God, but the bear I can pull to pieces if I like. And at the end of the scale, and at the other end of the scale, we have taught men to say my God, in a sense not really very different from my boots, meaning the God on whom I have a claim from my distinguished services and whom I exploit from the pulpit, the God I have done a corner in. So writes Lewis through Screwtape, thereby, through the mirror image we are meant to understand, the source of sin is possessiveness over our lives and possessiveness over our times. So Lewis writes with great insight. And from a Jewish perspective, I think there is an irony here. Because of course, how does Judaism remind us constantly that our time is not our own? Through the demands of Jewish law, which make many demands on our time, and ultimately make demands on our sacred time. The laws of the holidays are introduced by God. The calendar is introduced by God with the phrase, Elohim Mo'adai. These are my sacred times. And then all the laws of the holidays and all the offerings of the holidays are introduced. Through law, we are constantly reminded that our lives are not our own and that our time is not our own. And I find this interesting because, as a Lewis aficionado, one of the things that seems to have puzzled Lewis in his later writings is the nature of Jewish law. Later in life, Lewis wrote another book called Reflections on the Psalms, and also a brilliant book from which I've learned a great deal. But one chapter from which I did not learn very much, except in contrast, is Lewis writing on the Psalms that exultantly describe the laws of the Torah, including the psukim in Tehillim in the Psalms that tell us about the Torah being sweeter than honey of the honeycomb. Torah Tashem Tamima Mishivat Nafesh, the law of the God, is whole, restoreth the soul, Achkimat Pesi, it enlightens the foolish. And Lewis writes that he was a little perplexed. He understands law is important, but how could it be joyful? So Lewis writes in Reflections on the Psalms, this was to me at first very mysterious. Thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery. I can understand that a man can and must respect these statutes and try to obey them and assent to them in his heart. But it is very hard to find how they could be, so to speak, delicious, how they exhilarate. Now Lewis goes on to explain that, of course, he understands that there are many more laws that are involved in the Torah and that indeed Judaism delights in the very intricacy of the law. And he attempts to puzzle out what that delight might be. But he also notes that, quote, the law, like the sacrifice, can take on a cancerous life of its own and work against the thing for whose sake it existed. And he ends, and he further writes, it is the sin and simultaneously the punishment of the scribes and the Pharisees. Now, Lewis goes on to write more positively about the law, but he does describe himself originally to be mystified by the joy that Jews have found since the Hebrew Bible was written in the laws of the Torah. Today, of course, there are prominent Christian writers and thinkers that have come much closer to understand the Jewish love of the law. And one of them is the author of a book we've already discussed in this series, Maria Pogge Johnson, who comes to understand in an intuitive flash how, above all, what Jewish law helps Jews do is understand constantly that their time is not their own, and how the laws of the Sabbath, seemingly rigid laws, actually help us to sanctify time and to teach us about our lives. Or as she writes, quote, all the law, the 39 acts that generations of rabbis have multiplied into hundreds of prohibitions on the most trivial everyday activities, are an adamantine edge to chisel holiness into the week in a way that cannot be ignored or evaded by distraction and must therefore be welcomed and embraced and celebrated. And then she goes on to say that these laws help Jews, quote, experience time as creatures whom God has made in his own image and blessed and chosen and called. So she writes, for Judaism, in other words, the laws are a source of joy because it is the laws that allow us to sanctify time and the laws that remind us constantly that our lives are not our own. We have laws that sanctify our body and our marital relationship, thereby reminding us that our relationships are not our own. We have laws that sanctify how we raise our children, thereby reminding us that our children are not our own. And we have laws that sanctify our possessions, thereby reminding us that our possessions are not our own. This is why the law is such a joy. This is why the law is the surest protection from sin. In our discussion of C.S. Lewis, Shabbat and the Law allows us to append a fascinating footnote to this story, because both C.S. Lewis and Tolkien were in Oxford at the very same time as a very prominent Jewish historian by the name of Cecil Roth. Roth was a historian of the Jews of England, of Spain, and much else. And both Lewis and Tolkien interestingly interacted with him. Tolkien, during World War II, too old to serve at that point, he served in World War I, was asked at Oxford to serve on ear raid duty, keeping watch in order to alert denizens of the university town if there was a bombing and they had to seek shelter. And he was paired with Roth on this shmirah, this patrol of Oxford. And they would take turns napping while each of the other woke, while the other watched awake. And Tolkien was awoken by Cecil Roth. Roth knew that Tolkien was a very religious Catholic, and he woke up Tolkien not to take his turn in watching, but rather to go to church. So Tolkien writes to his son, who was serving in the war, quote, he says, then he describes that he was in a small room, which was cold and damp, and then he writes, but an incident occurred which moved me and made the occasion memorable. My companion in misfortune was Cecil Roth, the learned Jew historian. I found him charming, full of gentleness in every sense, and we sat up till after 12 talking. Side note, I would give a lot of money to have gotten a recording of that conversation between Cecil Roth and J.R.R. Tolkien talking along. He goes on. He lent me his watch, as there were no going clocks on the place, and nonetheless himself came and called me at 10 to 7 so that I could go to communion. It seemed like a fleeting glimpse of an unfallen world. Actually, I was awake, and just as one does, discovering a number of reasons other than tiredness and having no chance to shave or even wash, such as the desirability of getting home in good time to open up and unblack and all that, why I should not go. But the incursion of this gentle Jew and his somber glance at my rosary by my bed settled it. I was down at St. Aloysius by 7:15, just in time to go to confession before Mass, and I came home just before the end of Mass. By the way, if you see Oxford through the eyes of the Inklings, that was the name, as I mentioned, the name of the group of Lewis and Tolkien. So when I went to Oxford, first I wanted to go to the Eagle and Child, and when I passed St. Aloysius, I was like, oh, that's where Tolkien went to Mass, thanks to Cecil Roth. So that is the interaction between Tolkien and Roth. But there is an even more interesting interaction between C.S. Lewis and Roth, which very much relates to Jewish law and the Jewish sanctification of time. And here we have to do a bit of background. Lewis ultimately met and married a woman by the name of Joy Gresham Davidson. She was born a born Jew, raised by her, I believe, communist parents, an atheist, or at least she was raised an atheist and embraced communism at one point, one of those two possibilities, and then she converted to Christianity. She was met Lewis as a divorcee with two children, Douglas Gresham and David Gresham. And much is known about Douglas Gresham, and Lewis, Joy David Gresham died of cancer soon after their marriage. Lewis has a famous book about his mindset in his mourning called A Grief Observed. But David Gresham, one of the two children of Joy David Gresham, went on to lead a very troubled life. But at one point, he did return to Judaism. And this anecdote is given to us in the memoir of Cecil Roth's wife, her memoir of her time at Oxford. And she describes having what are called in British parlance at-homes, where you host people in your home. And there was a young man who came to one of these gatherings, I believe on a Shabbat evening. And she writes as follows. Cecil never found it very easy to start a conversation with strangers. And since only a few visitors were present at the time, the silence became stained. Finally, I broke the ice and asked the young man what college he was attending. Perhaps I thought our new guest was older than he looked. I am at Magdalen College School, he said. My friends from the synagogue brought me here today because they thought you would not mind my joining them. In other words, he's been brought over from a local school for Shabbat to the Roths. Then he turned to Cecil and in a very superior tone of voice said, my name is David Gresham. I believe you know my stepfather, sir. He lives at Headington. He's C.S. Lewis. Cecil could hardly believe his ears. Was it possible that Lewis, the famous author and Anglican theologian, could have a stepson sufficiently interested in Judaism to attend the synagogue and to invite himself to our Sabbath afternoon reception? It was a Shabbat afternoon gathering. And then she goes on to write, the story of David Gresham turned out to be a remarkable one. His mother, Joy Davidman Lewis, an American novelist and poet, had come of a Hasidic family. Her father had already broken with orthodoxy. She herself had married a Gentile by the name of Gresham. They had two sons. Eventually, she divorced Gresham and came to England to study at Oxford under C.S. Lewis. She and Lewis were married. She didn't exactly study at Oxford, but okay, I'm just going on with the quote. She and Lewis were married, but she died in 1960 while still in her 40s, leaving her two sons in Lewis's charge. The elder, a normal, contented schoolboy, was a loyal member of the Church of England. But David, the younger, had turned to the faith into which his mother had been born. And then she goes on to write that Lewis, quote, showed great patience and tolerance for the boy's demands, far more than did the Jewish undergraduates with whom David had begun to associate. And then she adds, eventually Cecil, meaning Cecil Roth, advised C.S. Lewis to remove David from Magdalen College School, where the headmaster was even more unhappy with his pupil than the boy himself was about being there. Cecil suggested that David be sent to an Orthodox Talmudical academy. C.S. Lewis's reply to Cecil's letter reflects the dilemma which the Hasidic boy presented to his Christian stepfather. Dear Roth, he wrote, thank you very much for your kind and most cheering letter. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate your kind interest in the whole matter. If David opens out and gives me the least encouragement, I'll try to say something, much as you suggest. Otherwise, it would be like trying to open an oyster with a paper knife. End quote. And Douglas Gresham has said about his, long after his brother's death, that C.S. Lewis actually did get kosher pots and pans and food for his stepson and facilitated his observance of Jewish law. The story of David Gresham is actually pretty well known to those interested in Lewis. And the story is complicated in a variety of ways. But it's very fascinating to read of Lewis engaging Jewish law in this way. And it's all the more striking, therefore, to bring this full circle, ladies and gentlemen, by noting that in 2018, articles appeared in many Jewish papers about a young Jewish playwright in England who had written a play called Theresien about the experience of a young child in Theresienstadt. The name of this playwright is Nicholas Tolkien, because it turns out that Simon Tolkien, grandson of C.S. Lewis, married a Jewish woman by the name of Tracy Steinberg. I'm sorry, Simon Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, Tolkien's son, married a Jewish woman by the name of Tracy Steinberg, and though it does not seem that their son was raised a Jewish observance, life has a way of surprising us with more twists and turns than even a best-selling fantasy novel like Lord of the Rings. Thus, an article in Aish.com tells us the following about the son of Simon Tolkien and Tracy Steinberg. So this would be Tolkien's grandson. Quote, their son Nicholas is Jewish, though as a child the family had little to do with formal religion. Nicholas attended a posh school in London where he was bullied when he told his fellow students that he was Jewish. The school didn't teach about the Holocaust. As a Jew, Nicholas felt like an outsider. That feeling of otherness would lift when Nicholas visited his Jewish grandparents, Anne and Mark Steinberg, in their apartment above the vintage clothing shop they ran in London. My grandfather prepared me for my bar mitzvah, recalls Nicholas. He was the one who introduced me to my faith, to the humor and the stories. He was always reading the Torah to me. In time, the article continues, Nicholas became very familiar with a number of biblical tales, something that he feels many of his contemporaries in his millennial generation are missing. Often feeling like an outsider, Nicholas remembers enjoying hearing about Moses, who had to live in a non-Jewish environment and yet continued to identify with his fellow Jews. My grandfather Mark was the biggest Jewish influence I've had, Nicholas says. Today, the article continues, Nicholas keeps kosher and celebrates Shabbat each week, end quote. Screwtape Letters is a book that has inspired me as a Jew. And it is very striking to me as someone profoundly impacted as a Jew, as a rabbi, by both Lewis and Tolkien, that these two individuals ultimately became linked to Jewish observance in their own families in striking ways. But in discussing what Lewis has taught me about time, I would be remiss if I did not relate the book that is Screwtape Letters to lessons in our own time and to the time, Tisha B'Av, that we will be observing soon. One of the most terrifying tours I've ever had was in Wannsee, Germany. It was terrifying because it was so placid. I visited the villa in Wannsee, where the Wannsee Conference had taken place, where the Nazis' quote-unquote final solution was planned. You are struck by how beautiful it is, an incredible villa overlooking a lake. And you imagine the people gathering there in that placid setting to produce the most intense and horrific evil. When I took a group of Jews to Wannsee, before we entered the villa, what I read to them was not a Jewish source. Rather, I read to them from Lewis's introduction to the Screwtape Letters. Lewis was explaining not only why he chose, Lewis was explaining why he was imagining not only what a devil might write, but why he's imagining the devil's writing in a bureaucracy. Why he chose a bureaucracy as the embodiment of evil. And this is what Lewis writes. And as I read this, we will put on the screen minutes from the Wannsee conference. These are the words I read before entering the villa at Wannsee. Lewis wrote, quote, "I live in the managerial age, in a world of admin. The greatest evil is not now done in those sordid dens of crime that Dickens loved to paint. It is not done even in concentration camps and labor camps. In those we see its final result. But it is conceived and ordered, moved, seconded, carried, and minuted in clean, carpeted, warmed, and well-lighted offices by quiet men with white collars and cut fingernails and smooth-shaven cheeks who do not need to raise their voices. Hence," he continues, "naturally enough, my symbol for hell is something like a bureaucracy." This is what I read before entering Wannsee. But it was only later that I better understood the connection between the Nazis and the Screwtape letters. And for this, I'm indebted to the website, A Pilgrim in Narnia. There we are told the following, that even as Lewis in his letter referred to a boring sermon as the inspiration for the Screwtape letters, in this very same letter, he also refers to hearing a speech by Hitler, where Hitler is attempting to make the case that if Britain knows what's good for it, it would make a deal with Germany, make a deal with Hitler. The website of Pilgrim and Narnia tells us as follows, quote, "On the HarperCollins digital book jacket, however, we don't hear the story about Lewis daydreaming in church. Instead, it refers to an earlier part in the letter. C.S. Lewis writes about listening to a speech of Hitler on the previous Friday night. He remarks to his brother, 'I don't know if I'm weaker than other people, but it is a positive revelation to me how while Hitler's speech lasts," he uses a different word for Hitler, "it is impossible not to waver just a little. I should be useless as a schoolmaster or a policeman. Statements which I know to be untrue all but convince me, at any rate for the moment, if only the man says them unflinchingly." In other words, and the website goes on, and we can share a link to this website, which goes on to actually give you the text of Hitler's speech. In other words, Hitler was speaking, Lewis was hearing Hitler speak, and even he, for a second, started to feel convinced by it. As the website of Pilgrim and Narnia concludes after describing the speech, he writes, on the website that quote, "The entire speech is an exercise in turning the conversation on its head. England is the aggressor, Germany the victim. England is dictatorial, Germany is democratic. The British are weak, the Germans and Italians are strong. Churchill is a madman without reason. Hitler and Mussolini are reason men of the world." And the website continues, The logic is to me very much like Screwtape's," end quote. In other words, perhaps part of the inspiration for the Screwtape letters was Lewis actually hearing evil incarnate speak and wondering what it'll be like to write letters from the perspective of evil incarnate. Today, of course, it's not that difficult for us to imagine people embracing the worst logic offered by some of the worst people in the world and still seeing themselves enlightened. It's not difficult for us to imagine people becoming, people approaching entirely wrongly the question of who is the aggressor and who is the victim. And this Tisha B'Av, even with all the wondrous miracles of our age, looking back on the past year, we may well grow weary as we ponder the challenges and the devastations that we have seen in the months before, and the moral relativism and perverseness that we have seen in response to those challenges and devastations. But these months that have come before us are a reminder to us that evil constantly presents itself, and it is our obligation to face it as best we can. And so I conclude this lecture by citing not Lewis, but by his very good friend, J.R.R. Tolkien, in the very beginning of his masterwork, The Lord of the Rings, in one of the most moving of scenes describing the reappearance of evil, where Gandalf says to the hobbit Frodo, "Last night I told you of Sauron the Great, the Dark Lord. The rumors that you have heard are true. He has indeed arisen again and left his hold in Mirkwood and returned to his ancient fastness in the Dark Tower of Mordor. That name even you hobbits have heard of, like a shadow on the borders of old stories. Always after a defeat and a respite, the shadow takes another shape and grows again." And Frodo replies, "I wish it need not have happened in my time." And Gandalf says, "So do I, and so do all who live to see such times. But that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us." So Gandalf says, "May this be a meaningful Tisha B'Av for us all, and may we be inspired in the year ahead to use wisely the time that God has bequeathed us." Thank you very much.